forecast for fiscal 2014 does not look too bright for the Defense Department, no matter what happens as a result of the shutdown. Day one of the fiscal 14 year saw the shutdown start, thrown on top of the pressure caused by sequestration. Todd Harrison's a fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments and my guest today on Pentagon Solutions. Todd, it's good to have you back on the program. You're publishing in Foreign Affairs a piece called Defense Cuts Conundrum, Weighing the Hard Choices Ahead. We've talked about these choices a number of times in the past. Is anything new developing as time goes on, Todd, or are we still seeing the landscape look much the same as it has over the last year to 18 months?
I think what's new is that, you know, we used to be viewing sequestration level cuts as the floor for defense spending and, you know, thinking we might not come in quite that low. We might be able to do a little better. And I think the situation has changed significantly over the past 6 months. And now the sequestration level cuts look more like a ceiling for the defense budget. And in all likelihood, I think we might end up going lower than sequestration in the coming years. So I think that's been kind of a downward shift that we've seen over the past few months.
One of the things that you write in this piece, which I think is particularly interesting and timely, is you write, the key strategic choice facing the Pentagon now is one of timing, whether to prioritize today's military or tomorrow's. And then you go on to paint scenarios as to how the Defense Department might go about each of those. Give me a little thumbnail on how you portray this in this piece, Todd.
Yeah, and I should say up front that I'm framing this as a dichotomy of near-term versus long-term, but in reality, there are, you know, all kinds of different levels you could choose in between, and it's not just one decision. It's thousands of decisions the department has to make over the coming years. But in the end, you know, you want to look at which way does it lean? Is it a strategy that leans more towards the near-term or the long-term? And, you know, what I look for in that is, you know, things that lean towards near-term, preserving near-term capacity and readiness of the force, that would mean trying to keep in strength close to where it is today, although you'll still have to take some reductions, trying to maintain force structure, trying to maintain current readiness. Well, if you're going to do all of those things, then you're going to have to cut somewhere else, and you would end up cutting your modernization programs. You would be, you know, canceling future programs, not starting new programs, or cutting back on procurement quantities. And so what you'll be left with is a force that is somewhat smaller. You'll be able to avoid making reductions at all. But in 10 years, you'll be lacking some of the modern capabilities that the force will need at that time. So, you know, you'll be taking less risk in the near term, but more risk in the long term. The other approach, the long-term approach, would say, you know what, I'm going to take deeper reductions in end strength. I'll cut my force structure even lower right now. I'll make immediate cuts. I may even sacrifice readiness of my force right now, so that I don't have to cut my modernization programs as much, so I can preserve those investments in new technologies and new capabilities that will pay off 10, 15, 20 years from now. Of course, that means you're going to incur risk right now with a smaller force and perhaps a less ready force. So from now, maybe over the next 5 years, you'll incur that higher risk. But in the future, you'll have more advanced capabilities. You'll be better positioned for the threats of the future. And so, you know, while it's not a strict dichotomy, I think that really is the choice facing the Pentagon right now and how they handle the cuts that are coming.
The first part of that I want to talk about is the inventory, and you write about some of the inventory reductions that the Pentagon's going through and some of the things that are possible for the future. But you talked about the concept of finding itself in a situation where they're lacking modern capability at some point in the future. I spoke today with a retired Navy admiral who said, you know, we still have the capability to out-inventory, to out-fleet the Chinese or any of our other adversaries many times over, even if we took a fair amount of our inventory off of active duty, out of service. And so I guess one of the things that I'm hearing him say, and I'm wondering what you think about, is the idea that technology to blow stuff up and destroy things is not likely to change dramatically in the next 10 years. Is it enough that that should be the basket we put lots of eggs into?
Well, I think if you look at the Navy in particular, take that example, you know, we have 11 carriers today, and we see indications that China is developing anti-ship ballistic missiles and anti-ship cruise missiles that could strike our carriers at a range of perhaps 1,000 nautical miles. Well, that's farther than the range of the aircraft operating off those carriers. And so that means our carriers, if they want to stay out of missile range in the future, if China, you know, progresses with its capability, for our carriers to stay out of range of the missiles, they would never be able to get close enough to employ their air power. I look at that and I say, okay, that kind of makes our carriers less relevant in the future. So maybe we're investing in some of the wrong things today. Maybe either, you know, we cut the number of carriers and put that money elsewhere in the budget, we change the mix and the capabilities of the aircraft operating off those carriers to keep them relevant in the future. That's the kind of rebalancing and focusing on what are the right future capabilities that are inherent in the long-term approach. If you take the near-term approach, you don't have the money to do that rebalancing. You just have to get smaller, and you'll be left with a smaller force that essentially has the same capabilities as today.
As I read through your piece, which I highly commend to folks, and I have a link to it later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, Todd, it strikes me that a lot of the things that you're talking about are things that I would have thought would be more clear with the huge number of policy documents that we've had over the last 6 months, 2 years, even since the beginning of this administration. And yet, a lot of the things that you talk about aren't very clear, and we're not sure where things are going. What does it take from a policy perspective to figure some of these things out if the policies, if the policy documents that are in place now aren't providing the clarity that we need?
Well, the first step is acceptance, right? They have to accept that the budget is going down. And that's difficult to do politically because then you're conceding a budget cut at that point. But as long as you're in denial about the budget actually coming down, then there's no reason to make these choices and to put that in your policy documents. So the first thing is you've got to accept that the cuts are coming. And then, of course, the second step is you have to be willing to make a decision, and it's going to be unpopular no matter how you do it. The strategic choices and management review that DOD conducted over this past summer, and they released it at the end of July, it took a look at this very issue. And it framed it up, as I do in the paper, as a choice between preserving near-term capacity or long-term capability. But the skimmers stopped short of making a choice. It just presented, here is a choice. It did not actually make a decision on which way they wanted to go. And so I think that's what they've got to do next, is actually make a decision, which way are we going to lean in our future strategy.
You write, the current force and those who lead it are strong and vocal proponents of preparedness for good reason. If readiness suffers, they're the ones who will bear the consequences. But senior leaders should instead be concerned that the future may not have a strong constituency. Explain what you mean by that, Todd.
Well, people often in the military, they'll say readiness has no constituency, but I take issue with that. I think that those who currently serve, particularly the senior leaders, are a very vocal and outspoken, you know, advocacy group for readiness. I think what they should be concerned about, the people that don't have a voice in this, are those who will serve in the future. I'm talking people who will be joining the military 10, 15, 20 years from now, some of whom have not even been born yet. Who's speaking up for them, making sure that they're going to have the capabilities they need to be the best trained, best equipped fighting force in the world? And in a down budget environment, you have to make a choice. You have to make trade-offs. Something's going to have to be sacrificed. You'll have to take risks somewhere. And I'm afraid that in this debate, the only voice that we're hearing from really is the voice of those who are serving today and those who served in the past who are advocating for, you know, maintaining retirement benefits and things like that. And there's really no one who's speaking for the next generation.
Todd Harrison of the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, my guest on Pentagon Solutions today, and he's writing in Foreign Affairs. What it sounds like we're headed back to, Todd, is something that you and I have talked about before, and that is the concept that rather than developing a strategy or rather than developing a budget, these two things need to happen concurrently. And what I derive, you didn't say it, but what I derive from what you write is that it's your sense that that's not what what is happening right now. Is that a fair derivation on my part?
Yeah, that's correct. I think too often people, will either say, oh, well, the strategy's got to come first and then you can build the budget. Or more practically, you build the you figure out what your budget is first and then you craft a strategy after the fact to justify it. I think the right way to do this is to do it hand in hand. The limitation is DOD has very little clarity on the budget, and Congress is not helping the matter by being so late in passing a budget, and of course right now not passing any appropriation bill at all, while we're in the middle of a shutdown. So we've got to get some sort of a consensus out of the political leadership of what the future level of defense funding will be, and always knowing it's subject to change. But if we could get some sort of consensus, and then DOD can go and craft a strategy, not just for that level of funding, but craft some, strategic options as well. Well, if I had a little more, here's what I would do. If I had a little less, here's what I would do. And then we can have a rich and thoughtful, productive debate about, where's our military headed in the future? What kind of capabilities do we need to be investing in or divesting of? And how can we start making some smart decisions based on, a realistic assessment of what funding is available?
All right. I want to talk more about the money issue and the budget issue when we come back. My guest is Todd Harrison. He's a fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And we'll continue our conversation on Pentagon Solutions in just a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and FederalNewsRadio.com. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and FederalNewsRadio.com. Pentagon Solutions today and every Thursday in the 4 o'clock hour with Todd Harrison. He is a fellow for Defense Budget Studies at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. Wednesdays is Pentagon Solutions, rather. And Todd is publishing in Foreign Affairs under the title Defense Cuts Conundrum, Weighing the Hard Choices Ahead. And Todd, we were speaking before the break about the money issue and coupling that with strategy and how that doesn't appear to be the way that we're going. How much of that issue goes away when and if Congress gives DOD a budget and says, here's what you've got and here's some sense of what you can expect in 15, 16 and beyond?
If they could get that kind of consensus developed in time, then they could start right now building a 2015 budget to fit within that funding level, informed by some strategy of how they intend to operate in the future. The problem is we're pretty far behind in that budget cycle. If you look at the way DOD prepares their budget, the 2015 budget request, they started working on that over a year ago. The services finalized their budget request back in September and submitted them to the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and now OSD is going through and reviewing those budget submissions and making tweaks here and there, and then that should be finalized by December to be released to Congress in February. We're pretty far behind in the budget cycle to be doing that. So, quite frankly, I don't think they can get to it in time for 2015, but maybe 2016.
Do you think, absent that certainty, that there's any point in going on with a quadrennial defense review for 2014? Because it seems to me, without that certainty, it's kind of an exercise in futility.
I think it is, to a certain extent, it is an exercise in futility. They could, to try to get ahead of the curve here, the department could go ahead and assume sequestration level funding for the rest of the decade. They could just assume that that's what they're going to get and start planning accordingly. And in their 2015 budget request, they are carrying two options right now. One assumes no sequester level cuts, and the other option is an alternate budget assumes that there are sequester level cuts. But they've not made a decision yet on which one they're going to carry forward, which one they're actually going to go forward with to Congress. I think it would be wise at this point to assume the lower level of funding, because as I said at the beginning, that may actually be an optimistic view of what the future funding level will be. If they do that and they build a QDR based on that as well, on that assumption of funding level, I think they might actually be able to get ahead of the curve on this for once and start putting together, you know, a rational budget and strategy that, you know, they can carry forward to Congress and defend.
And that sentiment of yours, as you expressed it at the beginning, that the sequester cuts are likely to be the floor, are likely to be the ceiling rather than the floor, you're not unique in holding that thought around town. I mean, this is something that it strikes me is commonly enough discussed that your thought that should at least be a consideration is very reasonable.
Yeah, and it, you know, and it's not that I'm hoping for that or anything or advocating for it. I mean, just looking back at previous budget cycles, you know, it suggests that, you know, the cuts, you know, could actually be quite worse than the sequestration level cuts. Because, you know, if you look, you know, we've had three complete budget cycles since the end of World War II. The Korean War, at the end of that, the defense budget fell 51%. At the end of the Vietnam War, the defense budget fell 25%. At the end of the 80s buildup, which was, you know, near the end of the Cold War, the budget fell about 35%. And so, you know, with the sequestration, we're only looking at about a 10% cut in the base defense budget. If you add in a reduction in war funding, assume, you know, by the end of the decade all the war funding goes away, then we'll be up to about, you know, a 33% budget cut. But it could be worse. It could go deeper, particularly in the base budget. You know, right now, even with sequestration in effect this year, it only cut the base defense budget back to the level it was in 2007, adjusting for inflation. So, you know, keeping that in mind and prior drawdowns in mind, we very well could go deeper.
Todd, Randy Forbes says that he wants the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, including Chairman General Dempsey, to come to the Hill and give a briefing to the entire Republican caucus to explain the readiness situation. We talked about readiness a little bit earlier. Is that something that you think would be helpful in getting people to understand where the impact is because of the shutdown and potentially because of sequestration? Is it maybe a little too late for that right now?
Well, it's probably a little late to actually convince members of Congress. It's not a bad idea to try. The problem here is really it's one of credibility in making the case. And, you know, the service chiefs and the Secretary of Defense, and this is before Hagel's time, this is when Panetta was in office, they made very strong claims about what the effects of sequestration would be, some quite specific, and then as sequestration went into effect, those things did not prove to be true. You know, they talked about, you know, having to ground large segments of the Air Force, and they did initially, but then they realized they actually had the money and they got them all flying again. You know, there are a number of other examples of like that in the other services as well. And so I think a lot of members of Congress, particularly within the Republican Party, are now skeptical of what the impacts of the budget cuts really have been. And, you know, I think it's, you know, they're looking at this more as maybe DOD was crying wolf. And I look at this as a budget analyst and I say, you know, DOD should have never warned that the effects of sequestration would be so immediate. There's a time lag in the way DOD spends its money. So there's a time lag when you cut the budget. And, you know, much of the effects from the sequestration cuts this year, we won't actually feel them until next year or the year after, in some cases 3 or 4 years into the future. It's things like delayed maintenance. You know, you will eventually feel the impact from that, but it's not necessarily immediate.
Is it just a case then where maybe they told the story in a different order or on a different timeline than they should have? Because I don't think you or any of the other folks that have talked about this have disputed any of the claims that the JCS has made. It's just a matter of when we see these things manifesting themselves.
Yeah, it's a matter of timing. You know, and it's a matter of the specifics of how the cuts get carried out. And a lot of the claims that they made last year were assuming that they had a full year continuing resolution, which didn't happen, and assuming they had no flexibility, which also didn't happen. They got a reprogramming authority from Congress, so they were able to move money around. You know, given those caveats, the things that they said may have actually come true. I don't doubt that. Don't dispute that. But the reality is that those two things were highly unlikely. You know, we've never had a full year continuing resolution as far back as I've been able to check, all the way back to the 70s. And of course, Congress is going to give them a reprogramming authority. They get some reprogramming authority every year. And so, you know, I think that they should have just been more clear that they were giving the dire, absolute worst case scenario, and perhaps also followed up with a more realistic scenario, that, yeah, it's not as bad, it's not as scary, but there are still some things to be concerned about.
Todd, always great to have you on the program. Your piece in Foreign Affairs is linked later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and I thank you for coming on to talk about it and all of the other issues that we were able to cover today.
Well, thank you. It was good to be back.